I'd like to call to order this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Good afternoon, everybody. It's good to see some faces. And a third hearing of the week, and we have a lot of business to get through today. So I'm glad to see everyone. First order of business is to take the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer.
Chair Liebling.
Present.
Vice Chair Hewitt.
Present.
Lieb Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Representative Ackland.
Ackland, present.
Representative Backer.
Backer, present.
Representative Bonner.
Present.
Representative Bierman. Representative Bierman. Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Damoth.
Damoth, present.
Representative Freiberg.
Present.
Representative Grunhagen.
Grunhagen, present.
Representative Keel. Representative Keel. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Representative Munson.
Munson, present.
Representative Pryor.
Pryor, present.
Representative Quam.
Present.
Representative Breyer.
Breyer, present.
Representative Schultz.
Present.
Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
A quorum is present.
All right, thank you very much, Ms. Niedernhofer. So quorum is present, and I'm gonna call on Representative Munson to move the minutes.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. I'd like to move the minutes from the last meeting.
All right. Thank you, Representative Munson. So the motion is to approve the minutes of 2-2-2-2-2. Who could forget? So I know you've all looked them over. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, please unmute yourselves. All in favor of approval of the minutes of 2-2-2-2-2, say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Okay, very good. So today we are going to hear a number of bills that have to do with adding benefits to health insurance. So the first of those on my agenda is House File 56, which is Representative Elkins. So because Representative Elkins is not on the committee, the chair will move that House File 56 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And I'm gonna call on Representative Elkins to present the bill. And Representative Elkins, we have about 15 minutes that we've allocated for each of these, just so you're aware. And I know you have a testifier. So if you'd like, go ahead and present your bill.
Going to be much less than 10 minutes, I hope, because I've got one testifier, but she's going to be amazing on this one. So House File 56 is the first bill to go through the new mandate review process that was created by my House File 55 that was passed last year. And the numbering of those bills is not an accident. I wanted HF 56 to go through this process, be the first bill through the process, because I knew that it would fare well in this type of objective analysis, because there are several states, Virginia, North Carolina, and Virginia being three, who have had mandates like this, and in all cases, the published studies indicated that covering lymphedema compression garments actually reduced cost to health plans by preventing much more serious consequences of leaving the condition untreated. So the report pretty much came out as I expected it to, basically acknowledging that this is a worthwhile thing to do. But the surprising part of it out of this is that the analysis basically said that the bill really wasn't necessary because health plans in Minnesota are already covering it. This finding kind of revealed kind of one shortcoming in the process, in that it kind of revealed that because the outreach that Commerce did only reach the health plans and not the advocates for the bill. And because the experience of people who suffer from lymphedema is that the coverage of the condition is not all that not all that consistent. So the testifier that I have today to speak to that aspect of the bill is Kathy Wright, and Kathy is a cancer survivor. She suffers from lymphedema herself as a result of the loss of the lymph nodes under one arm, and she's going to give you a brief description of the condition, so you have a little bit of background. But she's also a healthcare benefits employee benefits attorney, and she's also familiar with the state of insurance law, health insurance law in Minnesota, and which types of plans are covered and not covered. And so she's the perfect person to talk about the need for consistency in the way this condition is handled and the reason why this bill is still valuable.
All right. Well, Representative Elkins and Tim is right. You know, this is the Health Committee. It is not the Commerce Committee. So the issue really before this committee is the health impact of what we're doing here, not really to rehash whatever happened in the Commerce Committee. So if we could please focus on that. And Representative Elkins, I think you've made a bit of a leap in your presentation to sort of assume that everybody's read the bill and knows really the basics of what it's doing. So if you could just return, or maybe Ms. Wright can do
Ms.
that.
Ms. Wright will be able to,
right.
be able to do that better.
Very good. Very good, because you know members of the public are watching as well, and so we can't assume that everyone watching knows what's in each of the bills. So Ms. Wright, welcome to the committee. If you would just introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Kathy Wright. My pronouns are she and her. And as Representative Elkins stated, I have lymphedema. And I have, if I can share my screen here, a little bit of a presentation that will, let's see if we can get this to work. That will help us look at this. Is this something everybody can see on their screens now?
Yes.
So we can see this, Ms. Wright. Normally we send in the slides ahead of time so that the staff and I would know what's coming here. And just so everyone knows, I don't know what's in this presentation. And is it fairly brief?
It is very brief. It is very brief.
Okay.
My apologies.
Okay.
I'm scrambling today to get everything
okay.
ready.
All right.
What I'd just like to make everybody aware of is lymphedema is the failure of the lymphatic system to process lymphatic fluid, which helps the body flush out assaults against the system, such as bacteria. This can occur in a couple of different ways. It can be primary, meaning that someone's system is not strong and healthy organically, or it can be secondary as the result of disease or accident, as mine is. Lymphedema affects up to 10 million Americans, and that's actually both primary and secondary. Primary is much less common. I'm going to show you a picture of what lymphedema looks like when it is not controlled, and just want you to know that compression garments are a key tool in the management of lymphedema. In my lymphedema struggle, even though I've had very good public employer-based coverage, I never know each year how many compression garments will be covered under the plan. Some years it's 4, one it was 24. This bill is intended to address that by placing a requirement on insurance companies to cover compression garments and make sure that people have some predictable coverage in the needs that they have in working with their lymphedema. To give you some perspective on what the coverage differential means for me, I wear a compression garment. It's a glove and a sleeve that I wear every day, two separate pieces. And I wear it every day just like undergarments. I need to wear it every day. I need to wash it and air dry it each day after I use it. And the garments need to be replaced every 6 months in order to maintain their compression and their effectiveness. So unless I do laundry several times a week, and let's face it, who wants to do that? I really need a minimum of 28 garments a year, 14 sleeves and gloves for my single arm. And for me, this would be a reasonable amount for maintaining needed compression as laundering and use stretches the garment over time. And I only have one limb affected. Lymphedema can affect arms, legs, hands, feet, torso, and many lymphedema sufferers have multiple sites affected. The appropriate number of garments for other lymphedema sufferers will be different than mine. I ask you to keep that in mind when considering this proposed legislation and why it's important to dictate to insurers what they need to be covering. Failure to manage lymphedema can mean several things. The signature swelling, as you saw in the prior picture, it looks like water retention, eating too much salt. It is not that at all. Because it is an organ failure, it is a backup of lymphatic fluid, which have proteins deposits in them. So it does not act like retaining water. It's a different system. It needs active intervention to bring it back down. It does not just go down on its own. The swelling can be unbearably painful for some. It also affects our abilities to do everyday activities, sometimes even the ability to fit into clothes. At times I've had to wear oversized clothing in order for my left arm to be able to fit in a sleeve. Lymphedema that is not under control can result in infection, which Representative Elkins indicated can result in hospitalization and much more expensive interaction. And because it's the lymph system, it can be serious and fast moving. The lymphatic system is possibly the second largest organ of the body if you consider skin an organ of the body. And once an infection gets into the system, it can travel very quickly. The real reason we need this law is we need to require insurance policies to cover compression garments so it will result in broader coverage. And that broader coverage will be because group health plans that are sponsored by employers, they may or may not be subject to the state insurance law. Obviously, if they contain an insurance policy, they will. There are public employers in the state of Minnesota who are required by state statute to follow the insurance law. But even private employer plans that are ERISA covered will end up covering this because employer plans like to stay competitive with each other.
Ms. Wright, can you take down the slides now?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I can, if that would be helpful. Where's my stop share button? Oh, dear.
Thank you. Please continue.
Did it come down?
Yes.
Okay. It's still up on my screen, so I apologize. So again, I want to mention that the state insurance law change will help employers and other will help employers, employees of other plans as well, because those plans will want to remain competitive against the insured plans that are covering it. And another thing to keep in mind is that if an ERISA self-funded plan needs to hire a TPA to administer claims, and a lot of the insurance companies have a separate arm that they use to provide TPA services for claims adjudication, and they put out the same, they start with one platform and they modify it as the requests of employers come in, but oftentimes they end up covering more than they would have to because the platform ease of function and regularity can stay consistent the more similar they make them. So I just want to say that this bill is important because having more predictable access to compression garments necessary for managing lymphedema are going to result in long-term better health for people like me. And this is a really key way to move this forward. I thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Wright. Are there any questions from members? I think Ms. Wright is the only testifier on the bill. Questions. Representative Bonner, go ahead.
Thank you. I know that you alluded to this, and I'm not sure if you have the information on this, but I'm just curious. First of all, there's no debate that I think we agree that having access to a compression garment is certainly produces much better patient outcomes for folks. But I'm just curious, you spoke a little bit about cost. And reducing the cost of hospitalization or reducing hospitalizations Do we have any idea what the average stay is or the average cost for a hospitalization from patients suffering from lymphedema?
And Ms. Wright.
Yes, I'm sorry, I don't know that. I am aware anecdotally of people who need to always stay within 30 minutes of an emergency room, because once an infection starts, it starts very rapidly. And as we all know, emergency room care is some of the most expensive care out there. So the compression sleeves are not insignificant in cost. My sleeve and glove is a one cost $950. Now again, insurance doesn't pay that because they all have arrangements and discounts and things like that. But I can tell you just off the top of my head that it will easily cost more than $900 for me to go to an insurance room. And if I do end up with an infection, or if I end up having to get additional kinds of intervention, I've had to go through 6 week, three times a week physical therapy, massage to get this down. That becomes very expensive. If I have an infection and end up in the hospital, that becomes very expensive. So even though the sleeves are expensive in and of themselves, they do ward off larger expenses. And again, largely anecdotally, I don't know if Representative Elkins has anything more specific on that, but that's my understanding.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you for that, Chair Liebling. I think, you know, and I can't speak to this condition particularly, but I think the average is somewhere between $6,000 to $10,000 for an average hospital stay across the board. I can't speak to this, but I was just trying to give some perspective to that. And certainly I think we all agree that an ounce of prevention is often worth a pound of cure, as they say. So thank you for your perspective. I really appreciate it, and having the courage to come and testify for us. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, thanks for the presentation. My question is for Representative Elkins. Does this apply, would this be a mandate, and would it apply to both public and private programs?
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. It would apply to any of the plans that we are allowed to regulate. So it's commercial plans, but of course, ERISA plans are not bound by state law, nor are Medicare plans. So, but you know, as Ms. Wright testified, frequently the administrators of ERISA plans will adopt the state's state guidelines as well.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you. Just one quick follow-up. My understanding is that if a mandate for additional coverage increases the cost or the premiums, that the state will actually pay that difference inside of the exchange. But does that also, is that correct, number one? Number two, does that apply to plans that are sold outside of the ACA on an individual or group basis?
Representative Grunhagen, Representative Elkins started out by discussing this report that was done by the Commerce Department, and that is discussed in the report on the bill. But, and I think we sent that out along with the materials here for today's hearing, so I think that's available to you. But Representative Elkins, do you want to also just answer that briefly?
Yeah, I mean, basically it is addressed in the report. I mean, the purpose of the mandate review process was to make sure that this type of analysis was done on all of these types of bills. And in this case, what the report basically said is that the cost to the plans would be minimal, you know, literally on the order of, 1 to 9 cents per member per month, even if you didn't get the benefits that Ms. Wright described. The Virginia study that was taken into account in the preparation of Commerce's report showed an actual reduction in cost to the plans when patients were kept on a regular regime of lymphedema treatment, including compression garments.
So Representative Elkins, I think the question was actually a little bit different than that. And I see that Mr. Brickwedy from Commerce is here. And I wonder if he'd be the right person to, I was going to respond to you by saying that there are some situations under which additional benefits, if the state wants to add benefits to the essential benefit set, that the state is required to cover that additional cost. And we've actually done that in one case, and that is addressed in each of these reports from Commerce. But I wonder if Mr. Brickwitty, I don't know if I'm calling on you when you're not prepared, Mr. Brickwitty, but can you just, did I say that right? I think that's what Representative Grunhagen is getting to, and yes, why this would not be in that bucket.
Yeah, Madam Chair, you framed it perfectly. That was my question.
Okay.
Madam Chair, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner from the Commerce Department, you have framed it exactly as I would have. Representative Grunhagen, you are correct in that the Affordable Care Act does require states to defray the costs of new mandated benefits that would be imposed. And Madam Chair, you are correct. We have done that once since the implementation of the ACA in 2019, when we included coverage for treatment for PANDAS and PANS, which many members will likely recall because that came through this committee. However, Representative Grunhagen, in our analysis of this proposal in the report that's been referenced here on Representative Elkin's bill, we found that this proposal is not a new proposed mandate that would require defrayal and therefore have cost impacts to the state in terms of paying for those defrayments.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Brickwitty. I think you say that much more eloquently than I do. So, okay, final word, Representative Elkins, before we lay the bill over.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for considering this bill. I don't think I need to add anything.
All right, very good. Well, thank you, and thank you to the testifier. And House File 56 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health, Finance, and Policy Bill. Next up, we have House File 447, Representative Akam. And the chair will move that House File 447, the first engrossment, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health Finance Bill. Representative Akam, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And also want to point out that there is a DE1 amendment.
Yes, there is. Thank you for reminding me about that. So there is a DE1, and Representative Akam, do you want to, the chair will move the DE1, and could you please explain it?
Absolutely. Thank you. The amendment simply removes the exemption of medical assistance and Minnesota care. In this committee last year, we heard this bill, and it was clear that there was concern, rightfully so, about the bill not including these important public programs. So this amendment does now change the bill so that it includes medical assistance and Minnesota care, and it's more comprehensive now in its coverage.
All right, so the author's amendment, the DE1, has been moved. Is there any other discussion to the DE1 to put the bill in the order in which the author would like to discuss it? All right, seeing none, all in favor of the DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The DE1 amendment is adopted. Okay, Representative Akam, to your bill as amended.
Thank you. So in Minnesota, it's estimated that in 2022, almost 5,000 people in Minnesota will be diagnosed with breast cancer and 640 will die from the disease. Treatments have improved greatly over the years, but the best way to ensure a positive outcome is early diagnosis. And House File 447 removes existing barriers to accomplish that. Previously, this bill has been viewed as a new healthcare mandate. However, in January, the Minnesota Department of Commerce released their report that determined that House File 447 is not a new mandate, but rather a clarification of existing benefits. This analysis determined that by eliminating the barrier of cost sharing for breast cancer screening and diagnostic testing, the patients may be able to receive an earlier diagnosis, which can be life-saving. In 2017, when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, it was caught early. I still had to go through 6 surgeries, 6 months of chemotherapy, and 30 rounds of radiation. 5 years later, I'm doing well and cancer-free, and I know in part this is due to early diagnosis. I have heard the same story countless times from many others in both my district and from around the state. I want everyone to have the same good outcome that early diagnosis can provide, and House File 447 can remove barriers and help achieve that. I am joined today by Shaniqua James, a social worker with Gilda's Club in Minnetonka. She supports cancer patients and is going to share her experience regarding this issue with us.
All right. Thank you, Representative Akam. Ms. James, welcome to the committee. If you would just state your name for the record and then go ahead and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for allowing me to be able to testify in support of House File 447. As already mentioned, my name is Shaniqua James, and I am a clinical social worker and also the program director at Gilda's Club Twin Cities. Gilda's Club Twin Cities is a local nonprofit that provides social emotional support for anyone impacted by cancer. Our core mission at Gilda's Club is to ensure that anyone who is impacted by cancer does not have to journey alone. So making sure that they have a community to come to while providing the social emotional support that is needed. Although Gilda serves people with all cancers, a large majority of our members have a diagnosis of breast cancer and a story about the barriers that they've had to face in getting the appropriate testing after they've had initial mammogram or a testing that was recommended, diagnostic testing that was recommended from their doctors after having a mammogram. A member I'll refer to as Tina shared her own personal story about how her original diagnosis of breast cancer was delayed because she couldn't afford the recommended follow-up testing after she had her regular mammogram. And she has unfortunately passed, but it was a preventable delay for Tina's care. Another member who I'll refer to as Janice also has talked about having to sell her home and move in with her children just to be able to afford the bills associated with diagnostic services and testing and treatment related to a breast cancer diagnosis. And the commonality in both of these stories is that the costs associated with these services and testing and screenings just kind of snowballed into a health and financial crisis for those who I would consider some of our most vulnerable in the population. In addition, the lack of coverage for these services creates a disparity within minority communities that are impacted the most by breast cancer specifically, with higher rates of diagnoses and mortality. I do believe that this bill has the potential to aid in eliminating these disparities by increasing accessibility and early screening by covering these costs. I feel like it's our duty, like all of our duty, to ensure that individuals who are already facing stressful and potential life-changing circumstances are not burdened with making the decision to either pay for services that can save their life or delaying that so that they can pay their bills but live in a world of uncertainty. I urge the members of this committee to pass this important legislation to begin to close the disparity gap and make healthcare services more accessible. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. James. Appreciate your testimony. Are there any questions for Representative Akam or for the testifier? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I have a question. What is the average charge for a diagnostic service like an MRI?
And would that be to Representative Akam?
Sure.
Sure. I don't have that. I do know that in a letter that was provided to the committee by the Susan G. Komen Foundation, there was reference in their letter to out-of-pocket costs for follow-up mammograms to be $235 and MRIs at $1,021. So I assume that there is a range, and I'm not a clinician, so I can't say for sure, but that's some of the information that they've provided.
Ms. James, would you have any more on that? I know this isn't necessarily your area, but does that sound accurate to you?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is certainly not my area of expertise, so unfortunately I wouldn't have that information.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Representative Schultz?
Yeah, my question was just because, thank you, Chair Liebling, was, you know, it's the cost sharing is a burden, co-payments, but, you know, from my research, it sounds like there is a lot of variation in what's actually charged for these screenings, and we should make sure that the providers are held accountable as well to reduce those charges, especially for those who are uninsured and need the screenings. So it'd be interesting to get information from our APCD on the variations of these charges as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Damon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Akam, for bringing this bill forward again. Congratulations on your 5 years Last month, I celebrated 12 years cancer-free from breast cancer. So very excited about that. But my question is, knowing that this can be such a difficult time for people facing any kind of cancer, my experience is with breast cancer, but my concern is, what are the providers doing to lower the healthcare costs? And I know Representative Schultz just kind of mentioned that also. I think that's an area that we do need to focus on, that getting coverage so that people are not prevented from seeking care because of the costs. I think first we need to look at the providers, how are they lowering the costs? And then what could be done with this bill or going forward that would lower the cost of healthcare? And I guess that would be kind of my overall question.
Representative Akam?
And that's a great question. And I think that, you know, when you look at the Department of Commerce report, what they did say is early diagnosis was really what would save costs long term. And so I think that that's one way we can help reduce costs. And as far as, you know, healthcare providers and how they can do their job differently, I don't know that I'm really the expert to refer to that. I'm happy to talk more with you offline or after the committee to see if there are ways that any thoughts you have or ways we could improve the bill or address what you're getting at.
Representative Damuth, anything further on that?
Nothing further. I appreciate that, Representative Akam, and looking forward to working with you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Damuth. And I should just note also, members, that Dana Carter was scheduled to testify from the Susan G. Komen Foundation. She's not able to be here, but there is a letter that was sent out with the materials. In fact, there are a number of letters and a lot of materials were sent out with today's hearing. So please do look at those. They're very, very interesting. So next we have Representative Ackland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just felt like I needed to speak up on a just a little bit different issue here. Sometimes I truly am sympathetic for any woman that has breast cancer. My grandmother had breast cancer. My mother had a similar issue. But my concern with this bill is that it has chosen a single illness to put a mandate on our insurance companies. And I'm afraid that by doing this, that it would raise the price of insurance for all the insured. We know, I just want to speak up for on behalf of all people who have these insurance plans. This bill singles out one priority for additional testing, but we know that the diagnosis of breast cancer is devastating. But as I've pointed out before, breast cancer is not the number one killer of women. Cancer overall is the number two killer of women and men, but breast cancer is not the number one cancer. Lung cancer is the number one killer of women. And so when I look at a bill that singles out a single entity like this, I think about myself 15 years ago who had chest pain, ended up having to go in to see the doctor, ended up with an EKG, ended up with a stress test, ended up with an angiogram, ended up with a stent. That's kind of the same scenario. You get a diagnosis and it goes on and on. I was fortunate. I recognized my symptoms. I got the care. My brother, 63 years old, he did not survive his massive heart attack at age 63. My 58-year-old sister, she was found dead in the dining room at age 58, probably from a heart attack. We don't know for sure because they did not do a autopsy. So I just want to say, when we are choosing a diagnosis like this, as much sympathy as I have for a woman who is diagnosed with breast cancer, I don't feel like it's the fair and equitable thing to do to put that additional cost on an insurance, which would probably raise the insurance premiums and costs for all the members that are on those plans. So I just felt like I needed to say that because I feel like that's something that ought to be considered as we move forward with this particular legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ackland. Representative Akam, did you care to respond?
Yes, please. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Ackland, for your comments. I will just first start and say that the Department of Commerce analysis determined that this is not a new mandate, but rather a clarification of already existing benefits. And as far as picking just one condition, what I will say is if there was a silver bullet to fix all of the issues, then I would be more than glad to work with you on that. And I think that we have a world of a lot of different issues to deal with. This is just one of them. Heart disease is another. I'm happy to work with you on all of those. And that's why we're here, is to fix the issues that our constituents are having with removing barriers so that they can get the care they need and have good outcomes and live a good quality life. And so I'm bringing this bill forward just for that reason.
Great, thank you, Representative Akam. And let's go to Representative Bierman. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the bill today, Representative Akam. And thank you to all the people who've just asked questions, because I think we're hitting ground that we often don't, cover and state here, that there is a whole range of costs in healthcare, and it's a matter of balancing those and targeting those. And a lot of our healthcare system, when we don't get people in early, result in chronic long-term conditions, which ultimately cost us all more. I'll get to my question, though, which was going back to the first question Rep. Schultz pulled out, was, what is the cost of these two procedures? And I was interested to learn that the first standard screening was around 1,000, and the second one was only, I think I heard 235. So I was just wondering about the differentiation between the first test and the second, and how I was surprised that it was that much lower. And I just wonder if that test is so much different and it doesn't take equipment or time, or if anybody can help me understand that.
Representative Akam?
Yeah, I can respond, I think. And maybe there's been a little bit of miscommunication or misunderstanding. And when I was referring to Representative Schultz's question, it was about the copay, the out-of-pocket percentage that patients were paying or needed to pay in order to have those follow-up tests. Typically, when because we understand how important early diagnosis in breast cancer is, we have our essential health benefits will cover an initial mammogram for all women after a certain age, and so annually. And oftentimes it's after that initial mammogram that either it's not conclusive or needs follow-up testing or further testing, and that's where this bill is coming into play.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Akam, for that. And as I heard the conversation and we were talking about the costs of procedures, I think that is something that I'd like to see the committee at some point look into in more depth. We never learn pricing. It's very non-transparent of what things cost. And ultimately, we see copay bills or the small fraction that we pay, but the insurance pays the rest, and that drives our healthcare costs. So it is both procedures and insurance a big part of that, but it's because of the procedures that are being done and important ones at that, which this one is, and thanks, Rep. Akam, for the bill today.
All right, thank you, Representative Bierman. And I just would say to Representative Ackland and, anybody who thinks that, why should we pick this one? You should love the bill that I'm bringing forward, which is to get rid of copays altogether, and we're going to have more discussion about this, because let me just give my editorial comment here as the chair's prerogative, is that insurance really works well for property and casualty and is a really weird, bizarre system for healthcare. And out-of-pocket costs serve to keep people from getting healthcare that they need and make them delay care. And I think that's what we're talking about here with Representative Akam's bill. So we should be thinking not only how to do this for women who have need for extra screening after they get an initial result that doesn't look so great, but for everybody. Yes, indeed, we ought to be doing it for everybody. So I'm going to leave that there. And thank you very much, Representative Akam, to be continued for sure. And we're going to, so I will lay over House File 447, the first engrossment as amended for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So thank you so much. Thank you to the testifier as well. We will now welcome Representative Poston. Oh, Representative Quam, I'm sorry, I just saw your hand. Did you have something to the, we're done with the last bill, but we're gonna go on. You need to say something, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And along with your comments, I remember when HMOs first came out and there was no copay for a visit or anything like that. And I think we need to look at the history of why they added, you know, the $5 per visit and et cetera. And it'd be nice for us to get the data that was behind that activity so we can better understand the dynamics that Minnesota itself has seen over the years. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Quam. To be continued for sure. All right. We're now going to take up House File 2915. Representative Poston, welcome to the committee. And the chair will move House File 2915, the first engrossment, to be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And this one, I think, does not have an amendment. Am I correct?
It does not.
Okay, very good. All right, well, welcome, Representative Poston, and please go ahead, present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members. House File 2915 works on the issue of ecodermodysplasia. And I've actually had this bill in front of your committee once before. I've been working on this bill for 6 years. And we finally got some information from the Commerce Department and MMB. We got one of these evaluations that is in your package, which is going to, I hope, help us get this bill over the finish line. Ecodermodysplasia is a rare condition that can have a lot of different things can happen to you with ecodermodysplasia. We're focused really on three things: teeth, hair, and breast tissue in this bill. There are some things that we can't fix. Like one of the things is someone with ecodermodysplasia can maybe have a condition where they don't sweat, and we can't fix that, but we're trying to fix the things that we can. We finally got, like I said before, we got the Commerce Department evaluation, and the evaluation basically says that this bill will cost 5 cents per premium per month for all premium payers in Minnesota. So I think that's a very small price for all of us to pay to help these people that have this condition. Chair Liebling, I have two very good testifiers, and they have a PowerPoint that they would also like to show. And my first testifier is Carl Nelson, who has lived with ecodermodysplasia and has a daughter with ecodermodysplasia. And my second testifier is Molly Gonzier, and Molly has two adult children that have lived their entire lives with ecodermodysplasia. So with that, Chair, I'd like to let them take over.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Poston. Welcome, Mr. Nelson. Good to see you. And please go ahead and introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Yep. My name is Carl Nelson. I'm going to try to share my slides, which are way less than 200 slides, so don't worry. Let's see here. Is that working, everybody?
Yes, it is.
That's my daughter, Sammy. And so thank you and for having me, and thank you, Representative Poston, for helping us have our voice heard. My name is Carl, and as I mentioned, I have ecodermodysplasia and have my whole life. I'll attempt to summarize a little bit of my life in 3 minutes here, but hopefully I'll educate you on an issue that's close to my heart And hopefully after I'm done talking and after Molly's done talking, you're going to ask yourself, why isn't this already covered? Why isn't this already being handled? I'm hoping that you work with myself and Representative Poston to start closing the gap between what we feel are medically necessary reconstructions for birth defects and what other groups deem cosmetic. Issues like these have been going on for decades. My family's been in politics. They've been trying to work on some of this, but it's a hard problem. And we need to move forward together. And we need to stop history from repeating itself over and over again so that Sammy right here doesn't have to deal with the same stuff that I had to deal with or my parents had to deal with. We have to stop this cycle. Because for rare communities, the cycle can become generation after generation. And let's work together to try to make this a better place for our children or our grandchildren. So this is Sammy, and I'm going to now just go through a little bit of what, you know, what the heck is ectodermal dysplasia for all of you. It's a syndrome of changes in the ectoderm during development, and it's genetically based. So something's been modified. Abnormal oral dentition, missing teeth, conical teeth, or Dracula fangs. Abnormal, no sweating in many children. Severe eczema, abnormal hair and nails, missing abnormal breast tissue. There's other subtypes that can be out there that have really bad skin erosions, especially when they're young, hand and foot congenital malformations, syndactyly. Blindness over time is possible because their stem cells in their eyes don't correctively repair after corneal abrasion, so they can go blind. Facial deformities, cleft lip, cleft palate can be associated with it. We think that there's approximately, based on the incidence, 20 people in Minnesota per year that are born with this. Some of those are carriers and may have mild effects, and some are fully expressed like myself. And there's a most common type is what's called hypohidrotic ectodermal dysplasia, and they don't sweat. So they have a hard time regulating their body temperature. And you can imagine that be really a problem during sports or just growing up trying to figure out how to navigate that. Pictures are worth 1,000 words, so I want to just show you what can happen here. So we have a lot of significant oral changes that happen to no teeth at all, to a few teeth, to conical teeth, and you can imagine this is a very big component of speech and digestion. I mean, if you don't have ways to chew your food, you're on a puree diet all the time, and I'm not, applesauce can't keep you alive. So we've got hair, nails, eczema, and some rosy cheeks, and then the dentition. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my personal life. And I grew up in a small town in Staples, Minnesota, up northern Minnesota. Diagnosed at 5, had dentures at 5, worked with multiple, you know, Mayo, the U of M, multiple specialties to try to get a diagnosis and work through my care. We had my parents, as I mentioned, my dad was in politics, and he had to work very closely to try to get any kind of insurance coverage for dentures. And I know the rest of the world does not have this motivated father and mother. And so they fought for insurance with lots of denials as plans changed. Strong fashion sense. I just want to point out that this is a very nice plaid in retrospect. Then as I got into high school, you just want to be normal when you're growing up. So you're in the fifth and sixth grade, lost my hair through stuff. And it was not like smooth. It was like patchy and scab. Anyway, a lot of details there that you probably don't want. But I had to start wearing a wig, and the prosthetic was not covered. Or we had very few times we were able to get it covered. So I wore that wig from seventh grade until I got married. So the next thing I want to talk about a little is the oral manifestations. That can be pretty extreme. And this component can be life-changing for people. So we have implants. The small implants are here. This is a photo of my mouth. And it cost about $3,000 per little screw to get this in place so that it would hold a denture. So the total is, it could be $70,000 to $90,000, and right now this is deemed cosmetic, so we get this is out of pocket. And so for me, we were able to get that done in my 20s, loans and everything else. And Molly's going to talk a little bit about how this barrier is significant for them too. But this is a very significant, this is an oral restoration, a reconstruction, of a birth defect. It's not cosmetic. I can't imagine anyone who would want to go through what we've had to go through to get things done to say it's cosmetic. Let me just go through the bill quickly. Representative Poston, I just promoted him, but Representative Poston has mentioned this, but dentures, implants, bone grafting, orthodontics, and maintenance, we'd like to have that covered and part of a plan so that we're not floating out in the ocean with no lifeboat. So we want to have wigs and breast reconstruction. My daughter doesn't have any breast tissue, and she won't, and I don't, but it's going to be an important part of her her upbringing here in adolescence and in teenage years. It'll become an important part. So I'd like to make sure that we have that available for her. There's precedent in Minnesota for many of these things. So I feel like these changes are not much of a stretch. Cleft lip, cleft palate does have oral protections in the statute, wigs for alopecia areata, but I've gotten denial letters saying you don't have alopecia areata. You've got alopecia because you have ectodermal dysplasia. Same problem, but they're not realizing the spirit of the law, and we need to help them make that a little bit clearer. Breast reconstruction for mastectomy. And then the other precedent that we just talked about with Mr. Brickwitty, PANDAS, and PANDAS was passed in 2019. And this had actually no impact. There was not one claim against the state for this mandate. Peter Brickwitty can talk to that in detail if you need to. I'd like to introduce Molly and Hannah. Molly has multiple daughters with ectodermal dysplasia, but Hannah's the most affected. So I'd like, Molly, if you'd like to talk, I'd appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Nelson. And if you could take the slides down now, that would be great. Thank you so much. All right. Ms. Gansior, if I'm pronouncing it right, welcome to the committee. And please introduce yourself and go ahead. Oh, and you are muted still.
Is that better?
Yep.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee, for taking the time. And thank you, Carl, Representative Poston. We are here once again. I do have three daughters. All three are carriers. My oldest daughter is a carrier of ectodermal, but not affected by it. My ex-husband has ectodermal dysplasia, and they got it from him. And then I have twin daughters, and it's kind of fascinating. They're genetically identical, but one is affected. Hannah is affected more dramatically than Aaron, but they both need dental work done. So I'll try to compact this a little bit. So Hannah got the baby teeth she did get when she was younger. She had some front teeth, but not any other teeth. So they made her this teeny little, I still have her teeth. They made her this little snap-in appliance. And we were told to help her chew. And we were told that it was cosmetic and not covered by insurance. And she wore that for a short time till her baby teeth fell out. And once her baby teeth fell out, she didn't have any adult teeth. She had very few adult teeth. And we went down to the U of M, and starting in first grade, she got her first set of dentures. And here's her first set of dentures. She had an overlay made at the U of M. That's her top. Here's her bottom as a first grader. And I don't know how many of you, I think you've heard my testimony before, but it's still gut-wrenching to me. My twins are 25 years old. In the first grade, to tell a first grader to go get her teeth ready. And she's rubbing her little gums, and I taught her how to get the Polident ready and rub her gums and dry them off and put her dentures in for school. And while I'm fighting insurance, and they're telling me that this is cosmetic for her and she doesn't have any teeth to chew, and I have to work with the school with her food or pack lunches of food that she can chew, because these come loose. And then she has to go to the nurse's office during the day to take these out and reapply them because they come loose. And all the while I'm filing claims with insurance and they're telling me that it's cosmetic. It's pretty heartbreaking to me. And as they've grown, we've gone to the dentist and the orthodontist to move the teeth to where the teeth that she does have to move them to where they belong and then get ready for implants. And then we file claims for implants and we learn that those are denied as well because those are deemed cosmetic as we get letters from pediatricians, from their dentist for proper jaw growth. Her jaw wasn't growing, the bone growth wasn't growing correctly because with no teeth, the jawbone doesn't grow correctly. So then bone grafting has to take place. That's very expensive. And the bone grafting fails if you don't get the implants put in a timely manner. So now we're dealing with that. Both my twins have had bone grafting and without getting the implants installed in a timely manner, those are starting to fail. The other twin, Erin, she has an appliance made by the dentist with teeth on them to plug in the teeth that she doesn't have. She just went last week to get her third one at the cost of $625. And that's denied because that's considered cosmetic as well. So as Representative Polson said, we've been fighting this for how many years and just can't get it over the hump. And my girls keep asking me, when do we get our teeth? When do we get our teeth? And each time it fails, I just have to apologize to them. And the cost for my girls right now for the two of them is about $175,000 worth of work. And Hannah just quit wearing bottom teeth altogether. She's 25 years old. She's a nurse at a local hospital. She just quit wearing bottom teeth. She has a $3,500 ceramic appliance made right now that's cemented in the top. It's come loose a couple times. That also was denied, saying it's cosmetic. She has no teeth on top. And now we just finally succumbed and we just sold our house this past November so we can pay. We just decided to sell our house and we're going to pay for her teeth and start the process because these poor kids, I just can't have them wait anymore. They're 25 years old. And I look at Carl's daughter, Sammy, and I look at another family we're working with and their daughter, Ava, who's 5 years old, and they just found out that she has no adult teeth and she's just mortified what they're going to do. Do they have to use their retirement money? Do they have to sell their house? And when she gets old enough to help pay for this. So I appreciate your time listening to us. And I know I've made one other point with Representative Polston is a volunteer with Adult and Teen Challenge, which I just admire. And he has told us too, what's frustrating to me is that people that go into treatment, which is fabulous, but if they've been addicted to meth and they lose their teeth, our state covers implants for them. And it kills me to tell my kids that our state, my tax dollars pay for implants for them. But my kids who were born with this are told that it's cosmetic. And that's really painful for me. So I would hope that you guys would consider our plea and to help us push us over the edge. So thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you so much for telling us your story today. We really appreciate it and hope very much that we can get this done this year. Okay. Questions for members? I don't see any. So I'm going to lay over House File. Let's see, which one is it? House File 2915 will be laid over. The first engrossment will be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And this is an excellent lead-in to the next bill, which is about rare diseases. So this is a perfect example of a rare disease. And I think that we heard a little bit about the difficulty in getting it diagnosed. So Representative Ryer is going to move House File 626, that it be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And Representative Ryer, you have an author's amendment, the A2?
Yes, Madam Chair, I do.
Okay, Representative Ryer is moving the A2 to get the bill in the shape in which she would like to discuss it. All in favor of the A2, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails and the A2 is adopted. So with that, Representative Ryer, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'd like to start off just by telling you a bit about what's in the bill and the changes that we made in the amendment after the hearing at the Commerce Committee and based on feedback from stakeholders. The amendment does the following. It clarifies that services are from a licensed healthcare provider that had been a pain point previously and adds the word monitoring. So it now reads, no health plan company may restrict the choice of an enrollee as to where the enrollee receives services from a licensed healthcare provider related to the diagnosis, monitoring, and treatment of a rare disease or condition. It adds in two sections that increase access for pediatric patients with an undiagnosed condition under certain circumstances. And we've added in language that exclude conditions like measles that are now rare because of public health efforts, but that a primary care doctor can easily diagnose.
And so, Representative Breyer, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Could you just back up a second and just for those who don't know what your bill is even about?
Sure.
Could you just kind of give the most basic, because I sometimes worry the public is watching and they may not have read your bill.
Correct. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill is a bill that makes it easier for people who are having trouble getting their healthcare condition diagnosed, either because it's rare, it's difficult to diagnose, giving them broader access to see providers who may specialize in these conditions. Some of these are very rare, and there may be only a few providers in the country who are who treat these conditions or are equipped to diagnose them. And right now, it can take months, even into years, and many, many visits to a doctor, seven specialist visits to see to get your answer. So this bill makes it easier for people to get the network access they need. It is true that there are processes in place within the healthcare system, but I think as many people who have testified today could tell us, those are tend to be bureaucratic, slow, and put in barriers rather than opening doors. So this bill is about opening doors. We want to make sure that children have their conditions diagnosed as young as possible before they miss developmental milestones. We want them to have their conditions diagnosed and treated before they regress and they lose development that they've gained, and maybe even have their disease progress to a point where it takes their life and for no reason other than they couldn't get to a doctor that could help. So that's the essence of the bill. It's a network access bill. It doesn't make anyone eligible for services that they aren't already entitled to. If there were doctors within in state for all conditions, this bill wouldn't be needed. But we all know that there are some that are extremely specialized and that require a different level of access.
All right.
Yeah. So with that, I actually would say that the only things I will add is in addition to, we had run into a couple of things. One was that, as I mentioned at the start, measles is now a rare disease because we've had such success in our vaccination immunization. It's no longer prevalent. However, people know how to treat it. It fell within the initial definitions, and now it is being taken out. We have a much more nuanced bill than we had at the beginning. I think we have some things yet to look at. For example, right now, we only apply coverage for patients with no definitive diagnosis or conflicting diagnoses to pediatric patients. And we're talking with to get clinical guidance on having similar coverage for adults. So there's work to do. And we know that going into the having it laid over period. So for now, I would like to turn it over to our testifiers and take it from there.
All right. Thank you so much, Representative Ryer. So I have Dr. Tim Thema. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Liebling. Thank you, Representative Ryer. My name is Tim Thema. I'm in clinic, so I'm sorry. It's not a real fancy locale, but I just wanted to say I'm a child neurologist at Gillette Children's. I've worked here for 13 years, and I also see adults. So I do pediatric and adult neurology. I work with pretty much all rare disease patients, as is our sort of purview at Gillette, with cerebral palsy, neuromuscular conditions, and a lot of rare genetic conditions. We are very lucky as a state to have so many resources. At Gillette, we do see patients from all 87 counties in Minnesota, but we have a wealth of resources in the state that serves our patients well. So because I focus on rare conditions, and I've done clinic, and today I'm in Burnsville, St. Paul, I'll be in Mankato, I'll be in St. Cloud. It's a frequent concern that I hear voiced by families that sometimes they're limited in who they can see and when, even with rare conditions. And so I think, you know, removing barriers for proper care, number one, as was already mentioned, sooner diagnosis equals better development. I think we can't lose the forest of the trees. I mean, the goal of this is better patient care, better development, better well-being in the long term. And so if a patient with a rare disease, which is less than 200,000 patients in the U.S., they should be able to see the experts they need. And insurance shouldn't be allowed, in my opinion, to restrict that. There's patients that I see with Rett syndrome that should see me because I do research in it. There's patients with Niemann-Pick type C disease. I'm just picking a few diseases at random here that should see Dr. Patterson at the Mayo Clinic. We're collaborative in the state. We shunt patients to the experts they need to see, and there shouldn't be barriers in place to restrict that. Additionally, some of these patients may have conditions that need a broader community medically than we can offer one spot. So a patient I saw this morning in clinic has a rare disease I won't name, but they also can be associated with kidney failure. So I send them to the University of Minnesota for their care, and we partner together. As all the patients in the rare disease space know, they often construct sort of petition care. And to the best that we can, we need to avoid limitations and movements for the needed specialists who are experts in rare diseases. I'd also add to that, not only are the specialists, but some of these rare conditions, I mean, I work in a field where a lot of things we work with used to be kind of fatal and or very life inhibiting. There's new treatments coming on board. We won't talk about the hideous cost of these therapies, but I'm saying that these patients should be allowed to access the physicians who can do the work to get the rare disease therapies on board for them. Another concern for me is when there is House Bill 626 also talks about if someone's seen their provider at least two times and they haven't gotten a diagnosis, they should be able to access services as well. I see this a lot in my rural clinics where families will tell me, we've been waiting to see you for like 18 months. We keep talking to our doc and we've seen him multiple times and we're not getting the help we need. I would hope that there is some limitation in the amount of work that families have to do to keep seeing the same providers before they get the referral they need. Because again, this is not about the referral or the specialist as much as it is the well-being of the child and the adult and the patient with the rare disease. So with that, I just ask for support for House File 626 and I can answer questions at the end. I hope I didn't talk too much.
All right, thank you so much, Dr. Thema. I appreciate your testimony. We have Trevor Turner from the Minnesota Council on Disabilities. Welcome, Mr. Turner.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Trevor Turner, and I am the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council on Disability. I'm also a Minnesotan with a rare disease. I have a rare genetic condition called Usher syndrome, which manifests itself as a severe hearing loss and legal blindness. The Minnesota Council on Disability urges the committee to support House File 626, which would reduce or eliminate the diagnostic odyssey that many people with rare diseases face to get treatments from a specialist. We need people with disabilities to be able to get the care, treatment, and diagnosis as quickly as possible. It takes the average person with a rare disease 7 to 9 years from the onset of symptoms to get a formal diagnosis, largely due to bureaucratic hurdles placed on in-network insurance policies. In my own case, it took 8 years from the onset of my symptoms to get my genetic diagnosis of Usher syndrome. Much of the testing was not covered by my health insurance at the time. And under most Minnesota-based health insurance policies, Minnesotans with rare diseases must first see doctors within their insurance network before being referred to see a specialist that is out of network. Due to the nature of rare diseases, there are likely few doctors who may be aware of the disease, much less able to treat the condition. This requires a person with a rare disease to see many doctors and can be both a time and financial burden on a person with a rare disease and their families. I myself often have had to teach doctors about Usher syndrome, which most physicians have never heard of. It's incredibly frustrating to be forced to see several in-network doctors over years whom you have to teach about your own condition, knowing that there's specialists who can identify and treat the condition right away who are out of network. In many cases, a person with a rare disease knows exactly which specialist they need to see, especially if they're limited to a number of specialists who can accurately diagnose and treat their disease. Updating Minnesota law to require health insurance plans to allow people with rare diseases to see rare disease specialists right away, regardless if they're in network or not, would save time and reduce the financial burden on the person with a rare disease. The Minnesota Council on Disability supports House File 626 because rare diseases are protected under the American with Disabilities Act and the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And not all disabilities are due to a rare disease, but many rare diseases manifest themselves as disabilities. And this legislation supports the choice of Minnesotans with rare diseases to get treated by doctors they want to in hospitals they prefer. We advise the members of this committee to vote in favor of this legislation. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of this committee.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Turner. So those are the testifiers on the bill. Are there any questions or comments from members? Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Pryor, for bringing forward this bill. Thank you, testifiers, for your succinct and clear testimony of the importance of this. And I understand that a rare disease is rare. Not many people may have a particular rare disease, but rare diseases, people that have them as a population in the state of Minnesota, is actually significant. So I know that what we're talking about today really does have an impact on many Minnesotans and how we can best help them get the healthcare that they also deserve. So a great discussion. One question that I have for that Representative Ryer, and maybe not something that you have an answer for, but are all the states in the same boat where really nobody is recognizing these hurdles and trying to clear them away? Or is there some areas of the country where some of this work has been done and that we're seeing them as a model for what we need to do too?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would actually want to refer that to, I don't know if there's someone on the testifier who would know. I don't have the answer, but can get back to you.
Okay, fair enough. That's kind of wouldn't expect you to really. Is there anyone on the call who does know what other states are doing around this? I know we have some other testifiers for the next bill. So I'm not seeing anybody. So we'll have to take that one offline, Representative Pryor, but thank you for that. Okay, seeing no other questions, thank you so much, Representative Ryer, and testifiers, really appreciate your appearance here today and your assistance. And so let's see, Representative Ryer, we did adopt your amendment, so we will lay over House File 626 as amended for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Thank you. So now we have another Ryer bill also having to do with rare diseases. So it's again, it's Ryer Day here in the committee. And so House File 3676. So Representative Ryer, did you want to move that one to be laid over for possible inclusion?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, so Representative Ryer is moving House File 3676 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Would you care to introduce the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would love to. Thank you, committee members, for your attention. House File 3676 changes the Rare Disease Advisory Council. This is a group that was established in honor of Chloe Barnes, and her experiences in the healthcare system. And it exists to provide an opportunity for more study, more advocacy, and more education on issues related to rare diseases. So the essence of this bill is that it moves the council from the University of Minnesota, where it was originally housed, to the Minnesota Council on Disability. This change aligns with the intent of the stakeholders, as I said, for the council to advise the state and actively work on public policy to ensure visibility and equity and to address common barriers to care across rare diseases. And I have to say, today's testimony and today's preceding bills brought home to me how important this is and how we really all must be able to get the health care we need. So moving the Rare Disease Advisory Council to the Council on Disabilities allows for more collaboration within the rare disease community. It aligns efforts across other organizations and enhances the opportunity to have a council that has a statewide focus. The decision to make the change occurred through discussions within the council itself, and no objections have been noted, including by the University of Minnesota. This legislation just puts this decision into statute, along with related changes needed to successfully complete the transition. Thank you. I'll look forward to questions and to hearing from our testifiers.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Ryer. And so we have some testifiers. Representative Quam's hand is up. Representative Quam, can you wait for the end of the testifiers, or did you have something before we do that?
Madam Chair, I'm just getting in the queue for after the testifiers.
Okay, fair enough. All right. So first on the list is Amy Gaviglio.
Yes.
I hope I didn't butcher your name. Welcome, and please go ahead, introduce yourself.
Now, thank you, Madam Chair. You nailed it. Members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you today about Minnesota's Rare Disease Advisory Council. As was mentioned, my name is Amy Gaviglio. I'm a genetic counselor, public health genetics consultant, and I'm chair of the executive subcommittee for the Rare Disease Council. So first, I want to take the opportunity to say thank you for the foresight and commitment of the Minnesota legislature in understanding the importance of having a council directed towards addressing the numerous needs and gaps in care amongst the Minnesota rare disease community. As many of you are already aware, and Representative Pryor nicely alluded to this already, rare diseases, while individually rare, are collectively common, with as many as 580,000 individuals in the state of Minnesota having a rare disease. So bringing these historically siloed individual disease communities together under a collective umbrella known as a rare disease community really allows us to examine common challenges and barriers and advocate for needed policies to help ensure that all Minnesotans have the ability to reach their potential. So over the past couple of years, our very dedicated and passionate council members have successfully completed one of the nation's largest surveys of rare disease patients, caregivers, associated clinicians, and providers. And the results of these surveys really highlighted that the needs of the rare disease community are vast and will only be met through robust advocacy and policy. So for example, nearly 25% reported the inability to see out-of-network specialists who are experts in their disease. Nearly 60% indicated the value of telehealth in reducing the burden of care, and almost 80% indicated delays or denials for novel or investigational therapies for their rare disease. So through these surveys and really conversations with patients and caregivers, council members have come to understand that the ability for autonomy and advocacy and policymaking is really paramount to addressing the needs brought to us by the community. Unfortunately, under the current organization, we have been unable to find a path forward that allows the council to do this work to the extent needed. Understandably, the University of Minnesota has their own legislative and policy initiatives and risk considerations, but the lack of autonomy of the council is hampering our ability to truly drive progress. As a result, the council assessed many other potential organizations and have determined that the Minnesota Council on Disability would best serve the council's initiatives for the rare disease community. The Minnesota Council on Disability, and you'll hear from them shortly, We both feel that the synergy of our missions will be exceedingly beneficial. So House File 3676 before you, as was mentioned, provides language to this effect, while also expanding on duties identified as needed from the surveys. The bill should not require new spending, as there should be enough funding to carry over from rollover of the existing appropriation to cover the costs of the transition. So again, on behalf of the council, we thank you all for your support of this work and community. We urge you to support this bill, and we very much look forward to enhancing our efforts for the 580,000 individuals and the caregivers in the state. So thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Stephanie Tomlinson.
Hi, everyone.
Please go ahead and introduce yourself.
Sorry. I had a pop-up. Come on, I apologize. Representative Liebling, members of the community committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Stephanie Tomlinson, and I am the Minnesota State Ambassador for the Rare Action Network. I'm also an appointed member of the UDN Council, which is funded by the NIH. And for those of you who don't know, UDN stands for the Undiagnosed Disease Network. I'm also a patient advocate and a caregiver for my son who lives with a rare disease, and he is a research patient at the NIH. We are one of the many families that have been discussed here today. We have traveled coast to coast to find him equitable care, to give him the quality and the opportunity to have the best life possible. We know that we need to do this in order to keep him moving forward, and we understand that luckily precision medicine is on the horizon, and we do see hope. The rare disease community understands that progress in disease management, care, and research must be combined with good policy in order to ensure that access is equitable. I am a graduate of the Partners in Policymaking course put on by the Minnesota Disability Council, and I believe that true change happens when advocates are integrated into this process. It is estimated that the rare disease community is a 10% constituency in Minnesota, coupled with the Undiagnosed Disease Network. That number easily moves closer to 15%. The rare disease community supports HF3676 to give the Rare Disease Advisory Council a stronger voice in providing the legislature with recommendations to improve policy for our community. Thank you very much for your time.
All right, thank you for your testimony. And finally, we have Trevor Turner. Welcome.
Thank you again, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. Again, my name for the record is Trevor Turner, and I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council on Disability. As I mentioned before, I'm also a Minnesotan with a rare genetic condition called Usher syndrome, which is the cause of my deaf blindness. The Minnesota Council on Disability requests the committee to support House File 3676, which would relocate the Rare Disease Advisory Committee to the Minnesota Council on Disability. We believe a formal partnership between the Rare Disease Advisory Council and the Minnesota Council on Disability will be mutually beneficial for both organizations. The Minnesota Council on Disability is an independent state agency with a statutory authority to take policy position, advise state agencies, and advocate to the state legislature. Currently, the Rare Disease Advisory Council is unable to take independent policy positions or consult directly with elected officials. And this comes at a detriment to the rare disease community because it prevents the Rare Disease Advisory Council from taking a holistic approach to rare disease advocacy. And as I said before, not all disabilities are rare diseases, but many rare diseases manifest themselves as disabilities. Rare diseases are protected under the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Minnesota Human Rights Act. The work of the Rare Disease Advisory Council and the Minnesota Council on Disability overlap considerably, and we believe that we will be a stronger and more effective advocates together. Moving to the Minnesota Council on Disability allows the Rare Disease Advisory Committee to council to take policy positions which benefit the rare disease community by advocating in all aspects of the lives of Minnesotans with rare diseases. At this time, the Rare Disease Advisory Council is limited to clinical and academic research. However, Minnesotans with rare diseases are also face barriers and adversity in education, employment, healthcare, human services, transportation, and more. Living with a rare disease is more than just doctor visits and experimental treatments. It's a lived experience that impacts all aspects of the lives of Minnesotans with rare diseases and their loved ones. In my own personal experience, I have found that many councils and nonprofit organizations that focus on rare diseases focus solely on clinical trials or academic research, leaving very little, if any, room for advocacy for all aspects of the lives of people with rare diseases. And I believe that moving the Rare Disease Advisory Council to the Minnesota Council on Disability will be a pioneering step forward to a holistic approach to rare disease advocacy. And the Minnesota Council on Disability council members have voted to support this move. And by moving to and partnering with the Minnesota Council on Disability, the Rare Disease Advisory Council will be able to better serve holistically Minnesotans with rare diseases. And we urge the members of the committee to vote in favor of this legislation. Thank you, Chair Liebling.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Turner. So that concludes the testimony on the bill. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with the changing to, you know, from the U, which does have campuses across the state and whose regents are selected by the legislature instead of a group that's appointed by the governor, I do have some concerns with the change plus the temptation of not all rare diseases would fall into a disability category, and shifting all the money over. I just have some concerns that this may not be the best group to handle this, and there may not be sufficient things to prevent a blending of mission across from rare disease and disability. And I just wanted to see if the author had any comments to reassure me. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, well, Representative Ryer, did you want to respond?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Quam. A couple of things. I think that I hear your concern. I appreciate that. I'm glad that you're thinking about the implications of the change. I would first like to point out that the desire for this change came from within the council itself in their understanding of their mission. It is not being imposed from outside, and I think that they are best equipped to know what they need. I think that the, from my point of view, the Minnesota Council on Disability is a more independent, less constrained organization than either the U or the Department of Human Services. So from my perspective, their expertise as well as their ability to allow the Rare Disease Advisory Council to have its independence spoke well for that as a fit. And as far as all the money, I'm going to have to defer to someone else, but I have to assure you that it is a very small amount of money in the scale of legislative budgets. I don't want to throw out a number, but perhaps Ms. Gaviglio knows.
Yeah, I would say
Ms. Gaviglio. Go ahead.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Ryer, Representative Quam. I would say it's going to be less than $150,000, which is available to roll over. We certainly want to make sure the university can kind of close out any of the things that they need to close out in terms of existing contracts for the webpage, our current administrative salary as well. So we're talking probably on the order of maybe $100,000.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Okay. So with that, and I know Representative Bolden has a general comment after we laid the bill over. So seeing no other comments on the bill, House File 3676 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And Representative Bolden, to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to share briefly an observation and a reflection from this hearing. So first, I'll say thank you to my colleagues who have brought these bills to us today. Really important work, and thank you for that. And also a special thank you to all the testifiers today who brought your really powerful and moving stories. And just in reflecting, this hearing has been further evidence to me that we have a system that does not work for folks. You know, we've been having all this conversation about what should be covered, and it's very difficult to be covered. And it shouldn't be that way. Everyone deserves care. Everyone should have the care that they need. I look forward to, you know, continued conversations of how we make that happen. People shouldn't have to sell their homes to be, have money to, you know, provide care for their children. It's wrong. And so I look forward to working towards a system where everybody has the care they need. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Representative Bolden. I couldn't agree more. And also just want to add my thanks to all the presenters and all the testifiers today. Thank you so much for being here. And your bills are all laid over, and the work will go on. So with that, we stand adjourned.